Okay, good morning. This is Bible 241, and it's September 11th. We're in chapter 6. We started chapter 6. We're a couple minutes ahead of schedule. Thank goodness. We can play around with chapter 6 a little bit. I've got the schedule on the screen over here, so here's the 11th. We've got two lectures on chapter 6, two lectures on cell structure, and then our first exam is 2 weeks from today. And I almost have the lectures online for you. I got the website ready to go, and I just have to activate the link. So those lectures will be available for you to look at, or listen to, not look at, but listen to, including today's, because I believe my recorder is working. So is there any question on the schedule? All right, don't forget, what else is happening this Friday? A quiz, an online quiz. That's right, it's a deadline for week number 3. So don't forget about that. There were a couple people that didn't do week number 2, and you don't want to pile up too many zeros. It's difficult to average zeros away with good grades, right? Okay, so don't forget that deadline. I might send an email out to everybody, not to forget that online quiz. All right, so we started 6, and we had to define what a solution is, right? A solution is the fluid part of something, and the solute is the stuff that's dissolved in the major liquid that makes up a solution, right? So the solvent in our bodies is water. Solutes would be things like glucose and sodium and potassium, various kinds of ions. And then we talked about diffusion. What's the most important driving force for diffusion you should have on the tip of your tongue? There are a number of things that will affect the rate of diffusion, but there's one important thing that is more important than anything else. That concentration gradient, that's right. Okay, and if concentration gradient goes away, then no diffusion can take place. I think we're doing pretty good here. Let's do maybe this. Okay, so we talked about diffusion. So solutes will move from a concentration, a high concentration, to low concentration, and even a solvent will diffuse from a concentration that's high to one that's low. So it can either be the solvent or the solute. And this is where we ended up last time, talking about osmosis, right? Osmosis is a special case of diffusion. And one of the things that you should be aware of when you think of diffusion, is it an active or a passive process? Does it require energy? Does it happen automatically? It's passive, right? It just happens automatically. So molecules by diffusion can only go from high concentration to low, and that's it. Osmosis is a special kind of diffusion, which means that it is passive as well. And anything that osmosis can only go from a high concentration to a low concentration, not the reverse. All right, so there are three necessary criteria for a process to be considered osmosis. The first one is that it is diffusion, which means what? That it's passive, that the molecules are going to go from high to low. And the second criteria, as you see, we have them upside down over here. The second criteria is that in order for the process to be osmosis, the molecule that's moving has to be the solvent molecule and not a solute. So osmosis deals with the solvent molecule only. And in you, what molecule is that? It's water, right? So for biology, we're mostly considered water, but if you're a chemistry major and you have a different kind of solvent system, like maybe chloroform or whatever, osmosis still will pertain to that solution as well, right? But we're mostly concerned with water. But the strict definition is not water. It's the solvent molecule. And then the third criteria is that that solvent molecule has to move across a membrane. And I see a membrane on this slide right here, but it's got to be a special membrane. It's got to be a selectively permeable or semi-permeable membrane. So it will let water through, but not every molecule. So those are the three criteria for osmosis. Number one, it's got to be diffusion, which means what? It's kind of a loaded term. Yeah, it's passive, exactly right. It's passive, doesn't require any energy, and molecules only go from high to low. And the particular molecule we're interested in is water, which is the solvent molecule. And then the third criteria is there has to be a semi-permeable or a selectively permeable membrane in order for it to be considered osmosis. And if all those criteria are met, then it is an osmotic process. All right, so it's the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. But don't forget, that's kind of a loaded sentence right there. You should know the three important criteria. So water will diffuse from a less concentrated area where there are more solutes. And it will move to a more concentrated solution. So let's take a look at this beaker over here that has a membrane on it. And if I look at the left chamber and the right chamber, and I see, I don't see any water molecules on this particular diagram, but I see some solute molecules in like this big dark purple dot right here. What color is this big dot right here? Yeah, it's always kind of fun because I realize I'm not the only colorblind person in class. Okay, so this dark gray button right here, okay, or whatever color it is, these are the solute molecules. And where is solute at a higher concentration? Either the left or the right. Can you tell by looking at this diagram? Yeah, the right has a few more particles in it than the left one does. Okay, so this is a more dilute solution. This is a more concentrated solution because it has more solutes right here, which means that there's more water over here compared to over here. So here is high concentration of water. Here is low concentration of water because the solutes push water away. That's all there is to it. And so here we have a membrane, and it has pores in the membrane, and these pores are big enough to allow water to move through. Now I can see the water particle right here, these small blue little circles. These are the water molecules, and these big darker ones are too big to fit through this pore. So this right here is not permeable to the solute molecule. So these large solutes are stuck on the right, and these over here are stuck on the left. So that means since this membrane allows water to go through but not the solutes, what kind of membrane is that? That's semi-permeable or selectively permeable membrane. And we get the system activated, water will move from the left side to the right side to balance out its concentration, right? And it will do it passively when it does that. All right, when water moves over to the right compartment over here, guess what has to happen to the volume or the size of this compartment if water moves into it? It's got to get bigger. Yeah, it's going to expand when that happens, right? And this membrane is going to bow out or it's going to slide over or however it is you want to think about it. Okay, so since these solute particles can't move through this selectively permeable membrane, we say they are osmotically active. Right? If they can move through, there are many compounds that can move through selectively permeable membranes, but they will not be osmotically active because they won't shift where the position of this membrane is. Right? But these particles right here are osmotically active. And then when water does move over to the right-hand compartment, it equalizes the concentration of water on the right and left. Right? And then what happens to diffusion if the concentration of water is equal across this membrane? What happens to diffusion? Yeah, there's no net concentration and the difference, and then there's no net movement. So in this particular case, then osmosis stops as well, right? Because we're talking about the water molecule just moving passively across this selectively permeable membrane. All right, so concentration gradient drives osmosis as well. So the way that this chamber was set up is that we have the selectively permeable membrane with exactly the same volumes. And on the left-hand side, we have a dilute solution of glucose. You can see 180 grams per liter. And over here, it's a more concentrated solution of glucose. It's twice that, 360 grams per liter. So that means there's more water on the left. So water will move, will diffuse across that selectively permeable membrane into the right-hand chamber over here. These pores in the membrane sometimes are called aquaporins. An aquaporin is a kind of pore that your body can build and put into a membrane if the nucleus decides that that's a good thing to do. And it's under hormonal control. We're going to look and see where those are in the kidney at the end of the semester. All right, so would this be a good example of osmosis when this membrane moves over to the left over here? And why is that? How could you convince me if you think it is? Who thinks it is? Raise your hand if you think this is a good example of osmosis. Ah, you're still a little confused about that. Okay, well, here's a hint. The slide is titled, what? Osmosis. Okay, so that's a good hint, but that doesn't tell me why. You can tell me that's a reason why, right? And I would have to agree with you. Okay, but it is osmosis because what molecule is moving across this membrane? H2O, that's the solvent molecule. In which way is it going? From high concentration to low concentration of water, so it's a diffusion, it's a passive process, and What about this big glucose molecule right here? Cannot pass through the membrane. So what kind of membrane is this right here? Selectively permeable, so it meets all three of those criteria. So this is a really good example of osmosis. Okay, so now we're going to see why this is so important. There's something called osmotic pressure, right? If we set up this situation over here where the membrane slides over to the left, if we push the membrane back to its original position right here, that's going to take some force to do that. It's going to take some pressure to get this membrane back to where it was, and that's what we call osmotic pressure. So there are pressures that can be exerted on cell membranes just depending on the concentration of solutes and water molecules across the membrane, on either side of the membrane. All right, so osmotic pressure is a force that would have to be exerted to stop osmosis. It indicates how strongly water wants to diffuse from one chamber to the other, and it's proportional to the concentration of the solute. So if there are more solutes over here, then more water is going to want to move to the right-hand side, right, to equalize the concentration on either side of this membrane right here, even though the solute can't diffuse by itself. Let's talk about how we mix up some of these solutions, and then we'll look at some real-world situations that are real important. Sometimes we talk about a solution in a molar concentration. Sometimes we talk about it in a molal concentration. They're a little bit different. And then sometimes we talk about it in a osmolal condition. So you should know how to mix up these different solutions. If it's a molar solution, we have a nice flask right here, and it's marked exactly where the 1 liter mark is on this particular flask. Right, so if we put something in here, a fluid, exactly to this level, then we have exactly 1 liter of fluid in the flask. And a liter is what? A volume. It's a measurement of volume of something. Okay, so for a molar solution, we measure out exactly 1 mole of glucose. And you can calculate what 1 mole of glucose is by using that periodic table, right? And you have some homework problems to practice that, but 1 mole is an Avogadro number of particles, which is a huge number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd particles. If we take that many particles and stick it in this beaker and then fill the remainder of the space up with water, then that's what we call a 1 molar solution. All right, so we don't put exactly 1 liter of water in here. Because glucose is taking up some of the volume, we have to put a little bit less than 1 liter of water because we don't want to go over this line. That's for a molar solution. All right, if we're going to make a molal solution, we still start with 1 mole of glucose, which is the same weight, and you can calculate that weight using your periodic table once again. Put it in the beaker here, but now instead of filling exactly to the 1 liter mark on the flask, we put in exactly 1 liter of water in here. All right, so if we put in exactly 1 liter and there's already junk in here, like 180 grams of glucose, how much volume do we have? Greater than 1 liter, right? Yeah, okay, so that's a molal solution. That's how you would mix these different solutions up. And 1 kilogram of water, by definition, if it's pure water, is 1 liter. That's how we define what a liter is. 1 kilogram of pure water is exactly 1 liter. So that's why it's a little bit over the 1 liter mark on this flask. Okay, so that works for many kinds of solutes, but not all solutes, because some solutes break apart when we put them in water. There are some solutes that are held together by weak kinds of chemical bonds. Could you give me an example of a weak kind of chemical bond? Hydrogen bonds is one. Okay, and what's another one that's just a little bit stronger? Actually, probably a lot stronger, but still fairly weak. Ionic bond, that's right. So for instance, if we take table salt, which is sodium and chloride, right here, it's held together with an ionic bond, but if we put that in solution, there's enough energy in water to dissociate sodium from chloride, and then instead of getting just 1 particle in solution, you get 2 particles. You get a sodium as well as a chloride ion, and that's going to affect the osmotic pressure that can be developed by this system over here. So let's look at this example. We have these same 2 chambers, and it's an aqueous solution, so water is the solvent. Right, here's a semi-permeable membrane, and the solute molecules cannot move across. On the left-hand side, we have glucose, and on the right-hand side, we've got sodium chloride. So none of these solutes can move across the membrane, but water can. Water can move down its concentration gradient. So could that be an example of osmosis? Yeah, because it's the solvent molecule. Water is moving down a concentration gradient through this selectively permeable membrane. In this particular case, we put a 1 molar solution of glucose and a 1 molar solution of NaCl, right? The same number of particles. That's Avogadro's number of particles per liter of solution in here. Right, so the same number of particles, but once we put the sodium chloride in solution, what happens to it? It breaks apart into two particles. So you have double the concentration of solute on the right-hand side compared to the left-hand side, which means there's going to be less water over here because you have more solute. So which way is water going to go? Even though the molar concentration is the same, water is going to go from left to right down its concentration gradient, and it's going to push this membrane over in this direction over here. Okay, and water is going to continue to move until you get a 0.75 molar solution of NaCl. Okay, and over here, osmosis will stop when you get 1.5 molar concentration of glucose. But if you take into account the osmolality, okay, the osmolality of glucose and the osmolality of sodium chloride are going to be the same under this circumstance, but the molality won't. Right, because you'd have to multiply this 0.75 times 2 because you got two particles right here. You got a sodium and a chloride. You can see them dissociating. And what is 0.75 times 2? 1.5, which is the concentration of glucose over here. All right, so we got to be concerned with these ions that dissolve in solution when they break apart into particles. That takes us to something that's clinically very important, and that is tonicity. Tonicity is the effect of a solution on osmotic movement of water across a membrane. Here we've got three kinds of solution: isotonic, hypotonic, and hypotonic, hypertonic, and hypotonic. And I'm going to draw these on the board so that you can see what happens. It has to do with how water is going to osmose across a membrane. All right, let me see if I can remember this. If I have a marker, if I don't have a marker, I don't have to remember. Pretty good marker. Okay, so here we have maybe a nice red blood cell, for instance. And inside this red blood cell, we're going to have a solute concentration of 0.9%, right, NaCl. So if it's 0.9% NaCl, how much water is inside this cell? What's the rest? What's the remainder? It's going to be what? 99.1% water. So mostly water, right? The solute is really low concentration. And let's put this in a beaker right here that has salt water in it. And salt water, let's just say, has a 2% NaCl. And how much water then in seawater? 98% water. All right, so what about the concentration of water across the cell membrane right here? Is it exactly the same or is it different? It's different. Where is it higher? It's higher inside the red blood cell. Water can move across the membrane, but sodium and chloride can't. So this, what kind of membrane is this? Yes, it's selectively permeable or semi-permeable. So water is going to diffuse and diffusion, remember, is a passive process. Which way is it going to go? From outside to inside or inside to outside? All right, water concentration is higher inside compared to outside, so water is going to be drawn outside of the cell, all right? And what's going to happen to the volume of the cell when water leaves? It's going to shrink, all right? So it's going to shrivel up like this, okay? And we call that crenation. Crenation, and the kind of solution that produces crenation, it shrinks that cell down right there, is a hypertonic solution. All right, so you got to remember that. You got to memorize this, hypertonic. Maybe I'll show you a trick to remember it, okay, in just a little bit. All right, so that's one kind of solution. What are the other kinds of solutions? Isotonic and hypotonic solution. Let's do a hypotonic solution next. So here's a beaker with 100% water in it. How much salt then? None. Here's that red blood cell. Red blood cell has what? 0.9% NaCl. How much water? 99.1% water right here. Is water going to move across the membrane? Yeah, it's going to go from high concentration to low concentration, right, just by osmosis. Does that look like a big concentration gradient, 100% versus 99.1? I mean, if you just kind of look at it, does it look like much? It looks kind of small to me. I probably wouldn't be really concerned. You know, I really wouldn't be concerned if I had a dollar in my pocket or 99 cents. It's, you know, kind of seems similar to me. But you know what happens? Water is still going to osmose across this membrane. It's going to enter this cell right here. And so much will enter that cell, it's going to expand. It's even going to blow up when that happens, right? And we call that hemolysis. All right, so small changes in the concentrations of solutes can mean big changes in how a cell functions. It could even mean the death of a cell. So when we give injections to people, especially IV injections, we got to make sure that the concentrations of these solutes that we're administering are balanced and match up with their body. Otherwise, you're going to be hemolyzing their red blood cells and other cells in their body as well. So that's why this is so important. So the kind of solution that produces hemolysis is a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic. Hypertonic prenates, hypotonic hemolyzes. All right, and in particular then, let me try this little dial right here. So in particular, we would like to actually administer drugs to patients with the following solution. So here is that red blood cell once again. What's the salt inside this red blood cell? 0.9%, right? NaCl, what's the water? 99.1%, H2O. And so we have to mix up a solution that is exactly what? 0.9% solute, which we're calling NaCl right here, okay, which means then you have 99.1% water. Now, where's water at a higher concentration, inside the cell or outside the cell? Neither, right? They're exactly equal. So what does that mean? No net diffusion, no osmosis is taking place. So what's going to happen to this cell? It's just going to stay its perfect shape. All right, this one over here expanded, and then blew up. It lysed. Okay, when we say lysed, we mean break up. This cell is just going to keep its normal physiology, its normal shape as a result of that. This kind of solution is what we call iso meaning the same, tonic. Isotonic solution. Okay, so that's going to be worth a couple questions, I'm sure, on the test. And how are you going to remember that a hypertonic solution right here causes crenation? Yeah, the cell shrivels up. But even if I don't give this lecture for 20 years, I could remember, which you might want to know because you might have to take a board exam in the next couple of years and you have to know this stuff. Okay, here's a little trick that I use. And you can use it as well, okay? But I don't want you to tell anybody I told you this trick because it's kind of silly, all right? It's really good for you to understand the physics that's going on here, but there's an E in hypertonic, there's an E in crenation, okay? I know there's an O in hypotonic, there's an O in hemolysis. So on the test, understand the process, right, that's going on, but then double-check your answer on your test, okay? All right. Or if it's in 10 or 15 years from now and you got to get recertified, you could always thank me. Okay, send me an email. So isotonic solution maintains the size and shape of the cell. A hypotonic solution will cause the cell to expand and probably eventually lyse, even if it's just a small concentration difference, right? And a cell will crenate if it's in a hypertonic solution. All right, do these processes qualify for osmosis? Yeah, because sodium chloride can't move across the membrane, so it's selectively permeable. It's the solvent molecule that's moving down its concentration gradient. It's just plain old diffusion. So for sure it is. Hemolysis is an irreversible process, right? If you have a balloon and blow it up so with so much air it bursts, then that balloon is destroyed, right? You can't ever get that cell back together again. So that's a particularly dangerous circumstance. If a cell is crenated, you can actually rehydrate it. It's not an irreversible process. You can rehydrate this cell to get it back to its normal shape. How would you do that? Kind of an interesting trick question. Let's see if you guys are kind of following the discussion. How would you take a crenated cell and get it back to its original shape? You would take that cell and put it in where? an isotonic solution. And water will diffuse in until it's exactly where it should be, and the cell has the exact same shape. Okay, but once the cell hemolyzes, you can't ever get it back again. All right, so regulation of osmolality in your body is crucial because you don't want your body swelling up drastically. You don't want to hemolyze cells. And, there's another particularly interesting case. It's happened a number of times. You can see if you drink too much water, you can overdose on water. Okay, because you can have so much water in your body that it is no longer isotonic, it becomes hypotonic and water starts to enter cells. There was a contest, and this happened in a couple other circumstances. There was a contest where there was a pickup truck, a nice brand new pickup truck that was going to be given away to somebody maybe about 3 years ago, depending on how much water they drank. Right? So about 50 people got together, it was run by a radio station, and somebody needed a pickup truck for work really bad so they could support their family. And so they just had their mind made up that they were going to drink more water than anybody else. And this poor woman drank maybe 2.5 gallons. And there was even a nurse at this contest. And the nurse said, you know what, you're in trouble. You need to go to the emergency room. And unfortunately, this person didn't take a physiology class like this and said, no, I need the pickup truck more than anything else. And didn't go to the emergency room. And what happened was that she drank so much water that it went into her cells, right, because her body became hypotonic. And her cells started to expand. Okay, and it's okay if your hands expand. Sometimes, you know, your hands feel puffy or something like that. But there's one part of the body that is really difficult. Does anybody know what part of your body just can't expand? Yeah, your cranium, your skull. Those bones don't expand. So all that water went into her brain. Her brain started to expand. Okay, and then what happens? Yeah, it goes through the foramen magnum. Okay, and other foramina in the base of the skull. And unfortunately, she didn't get to the emergency room fast enough. So it is possible to overdose on water that produces these kinds of tonicity problems. All right, so. Well, I think the kidneys she drank water so fast that the kidneys couldn't keep up with it. I would guess if she drank that same amount of water over a smaller period of time, then the kidneys would compensate for that. And we're going to see how the kidneys actually do that. If you give your body a chance, all right, but I think she just drank so much water so fast that she couldn't pee it out. Okay. Now, if you do need to drink a lot of fluids, maybe you need to exercise your kidneys for a couple reasons, medical reasons. What kind of solution would you want to drink? You could drink a solution to help protect your body, okay, and that's going to be an isotonic solution. Okay, that's going to maintain the health of all your cells. Like, there's one you can buy in the grocery store called Pedialyte. Okay, and it's not L-I-G-H-T, it's L-Y-T-E for electrolytes. Okay, and even you can imagine that infants even are more sensitive to these osmotic changes than adults are. But as an adult, you could do that. All right, so how does your body regulate salt concentration and water concentration in your body so it doesn't produce these kinds of problems? Blood osmolality is around 300 milliosmolar, okay, in the normal conditions. If dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus then can stimulate the release of a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. And what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. An antidiuretic keeps you from peeing, so that means that it helps you retain water. All right, so ADH, and you've heard of ADH in anatomy already, comes from the posterior pituitary gland. All right, so when you become dehydrated, you lose blood volume. The salt concentration increases in the blood, so that increases osmolality. You become more salty. That stimulates osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. Right, and so as your body is becoming less hydrated or dehydrated or more salty, the hypothalamus gives you the sensation of thirst. All right, so you actually get a sensation of thirst, and then, of course, when you're thirsty, you drink. That increases water intake, right? Increases water retention due to this other mechanism that I'm going to talk a little bit about. All right, and if you increase water in your body, what happens to your blood volume? It goes up. Okay, so the response is opposite to this initial stimulus right here. So what kind of feedback mechanism is that? Nice negative feedback mechanism. Oh, I said nice. Is it a nice mechanism? It's a negative feedback mechanism, but is it nice? Yeah, why? Because what does it do? It maintains homeostasis. All right, the hypothalamus then can also communicate with the posterior pituitary, just because there's a tract that goes from the hypothalamus down into the posterior pituitary. When the action potential hits the axon terminus in the posterior pituitary, it releases a compound called antidiuretic hormone. That's a neurohormone. Kind of looks like a neurotransmitter, but it gets picked up by the blood, taken everywhere, in particular the kidneys, where there are receptors for antidiuretic hormone, and that then reduces the amount of fluid that the kidneys produce as urine. All right, so that means that helps you retain water, which then also feeds back in a negative way to increase blood volume and to decrease the saltiness of your blood. Okay, and that gets you back into homeostasis. All right, so this is a particularly important hormone for maintaining the osmolality, which is the salt concentration or water balance inside your body. All right, any questions on that before we get into membrane transport systems? And I think you do some pretty nice experiments in lab with this. I don't know if you've done them yet or not. Okay, carrier-mediated transport across the cell membrane. When molecules are too large to fit through pores within a membrane, or maybe they're too polar to diffuse, but they need to get inside the cell, they're transported by protein carrier molecules. All right, so you should be familiar with polar. What's the opposite of polar? Nonpolar. What is a membrane? Is it polar or nonpolar? A membrane is nonpolar, right? It's a lipid. It's a phospholipid bilayer. I guess maybe we didn't talk about that yet, okay? The inside is a lipid layer, okay? And since it's a lipid layer, it's nonpolar, so that means things that like to dissolve in water can't diffuse or go across the cell membrane. They're excluded from being transported across the cell membrane. Okay, but if there's a carrier molecule there, then it can be transported across. But the molecule that's being transported must bind to a membrane protein first. All right, so there must be binding of the molecule to the carrier protein before it's transported inside the cell. So here's a chart, here's a graph that shows a couple important characteristics of, you could look at this and think of receptor binding, you could think of this as a binding of substrate to an enzyme, but we're just going to look at it in terms of how a solute is being transported across the membrane. So here is the rate of transport of some solute X, that could be glucose or something, okay, versus its concentration on the outside of the cell. And the three criteria or the three characteristics for this particular process is that there's a lot of specificity, there's a high level of specificity, there's competition between substrates, and there's a saturation effect. Let's see if I can describe some of these things. Specificity. We said that the molecule that's being transported, let's just say X right here, has to bind to the transporter molecule. And the way that we understand how that binding occurs is by the shape. The shape of the molecule that's being transported has to be complementary to the shape of the transporter. So if you want a key to work and a lock, is there a relationship between the key and the locking mechanism? Yeah, the teeth have to match up with the tumblers, otherwise a key is not going to work and open a lock. What about a glove? In order for your hand to fit inside the glove, it's got to be the right hand or the left hand, it's got to have the correct number of fingers, right? So it's the shape of these things that have to match up. And that's how we think about specificity. If a molecule has the right shape, then it can be transported, but if it's a distant cousin type molecule, has a different shape, then it can't be transported. So we say that these carrier systems are highly specific. Maybe you could remember galactose and glucose, they're monosaccharides. They look really similar. They're both simple sugars. Fructose is a simple sugar, but it looks a little bit different. Okay, so you might have a transporter that could transport glucose or galactose pretty easily, but not fructose because its shape is different enough, won't allow it to go through. All right, so that's specificity. Competition among substrates. All right, so let's look at, here's a graph of transport versus concentration of X. Okay, if we increase the concentration across the membrane, we see that the rate of transport increases. All right, and then it kind of levels out at this rate right here. And if we increase the concentration of X, it doesn't get any higher. All right. But if we have, for instance, X and Y, or maybe we could say glucose and galactose in solution, and then measure the transport of just glucose, even though we're increasing the concentration of X, look, the dotted line right here is a lesser rate compared to if glucose was in solution by itself. And that's because this other molecule right here, like we said, for example, maybe galactose is binding to the binding site where glucose has to bind. And if glucose can't bind to that binding site, then the rate is decreased. Okay, but if we put fructose in here, it wouldn't bind to the binding site, and the rate would probably be about the same, because fructose is a lot different kind of molecule, even though it's a simple sugar. Okay, so this plateau region right here, then, is the last consideration. We call that saturation. We see that the rate kind of bottoms out, even though we can increase the concentration of X. We say it is completely saturated. So when you have so much of solute, X, in solution that all the binding sites on the transporter molecule is bound up with X, then it can't carry any more molecules across the membrane, even if we increase the concentration of X outside the cell. We call that the transport maximum, or the TM. And we can just measure that. We can just go right across and measure what that is on this axis right here. All right, so you should know specificity by shape, competition. If there is a molecule that's similar in shape, it can inhibit the transport, all right, and then in a membrane there are only so many transporters, and when they're completely saturated with the solute molecule, then the mechanism can't go any faster, and that's what we call saturation. So let's look at a special case of diffusion. Here I see water, and over here I see water outside the cell, here's water inside the cell. And here is a simple monosaccharide like glucose. Kind of looks like a stop sign. And where is glucose at a higher concentration? Outside or inside? It's higher outside. So glucose wants to get inside the cell, right? Yeah, because it wants to go from high concentration to low concentration. But remember, glucose has a lot of OH groups on it, oxygens, and an OH is a polar function. So it makes glucose very polar, and that's why glucose loves to dissolve in water, because water is a polar solvent. But here is that membrane. Here is that nonpolar barrier, the fatty acids that are sticking into the center of the membrane. Glucose by itself can't get across this barrier because glucose is polar, but the membrane is nonpolar. They don't like each other, right? They repel each other. So glucose can't get in, even though it's dying to get in because it's high concentration outside, low concentration inside. But glucose is an important metabolite. It's an important energy molecule. Cells want glucose, so even though the membrane is excluding it, the nucleus puts in a special membrane protein right here, and this is a glucose transporter. And so we can see that it kind of acts like a teeter-totter. It can be open to the outside of the cell, or it could be open to the inside of the cell, but it won't be open to both the inside and outside at the exact same time. It's going to be open to one side or the other. And it can flip back and forth. So we have high concentration of glucose. It's going to come in, and what did we say? It's got to bind to the protein. So it binds to this receptor site. And look, the shape of this site right here matches up with the shape of the molecule that's going to be transported. And when it binds, right, it changes the conformation of this protein right here. There's enough of an energy change to cause this little teeter-totter to flip. And now it's closed to the outside, open to the inside. And then the glucose molecule is released, and it is inside the cell. All right, so is this an active or a passive process? Something is moving from high concentration to low. High concentration to low. Passive process. Does not require energy. There's enough energy in the gradient to move glucose inside the cell by diffusion. Okay. So, and as a matter of fact, there's enough energy in this concentration gradient to cause this conformation change in this protein right here. If the concentration was the same, there would be not enough energy to cause a change in conformation of this protein. All right, so when glucose binds to this protein right here, I want you to think of, you're sitting taking notes right now, and you have your best friend sitting next to you, right? And your best friend takes their index finger and pokes you in the side. What are you going to do? You're going to change conformation a little bit. It's not a really disturbing kind of force, right? But you're going to change conformation. The same thing for this protein. When it gets poked in the side, when it binds this glucose, it's going to change conformation, and that allows glucose to enter the cell by a process we call facilitated diffusion. It's still passive, but it can't happen unless this protein is in the membrane. Okay, so sometimes cells have these proteins in the membrane, and sometimes they don't. Here's a vesicle inside the cell. It's a membrane structure. It has a phospholipid bilayer, just like the plasma membrane right here. And inserted into the endosome, this vesicle, are these carrier molecules for glucose. All right, but can these carrier molecules right here transport glucose from outside the cell to inside? No, because these are now trapped inside the cell completely. But if the cell gets a signal to move this vesicle over to the plasma membrane, they fuse together, and now you have these transporters in the cell membrane, what can happen? The cell can take up glucose. Okay? All right, so this endosome is just a storage area for these transporters that can be inserted into the cell membrane very rapidly so that the cell can take up glucose. And it's under the control of insulin. Okay, so insulin tells this endosome to move over to the plasma membrane, insert these transporters, and when there's insulin around, what happens to glucose? It goes from outside a cell to the inside of the cell. It allows glucose to be taken up by cells. It's the passport that allows glucose to enter cells because it inserts these transporters into the cell membrane. Okay, we're going to look at insulin and these transporters, different kinds of glucose transporters, a lot in this class. Okay, but remember, this is still a passive process that we call facilitated diffusion. All right, and when the insulin signal goes away, then the cell just sequesters all of these transporters, puts it back into this vesicle inside the cell, and now the cell can't take up glucose. And if that mechanism goes awry, even though there's an insulin signal present, sometimes, like diabetes type 2, okay, these cells can't take up glucose, and then these cells start to starve to death as a result of that. Okay, so that's a pretty important process that we're going to understand. Active transport. Okay, we still have this nice phospholipid bilayer, a cell membrane, and let's talk about another compound, namely calcium. It's an ion. Could you describe, what kind of ion is this? It's a cation. What kind of cation? It's a bivalent cation because I see a plus 2 right here. Sodium will be a monovalent cation because it has just a single plus. Right, the chlorine would be a single minus. That would be a monovalent anion. Okay, so I'll use those terms when I'm lecturing. Here we see a protein inserted into the membrane, and it kind of teeter-totters once again. Right, it can be open to the inside of the cell. It could be open to the outside, but not both at the same time. We have calcium at a low concentration on the inside of the cell, calcium at a high concentration on the inside. But this is a special kind of protein right here because it can bind ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is a high-energy molecule. And when it gets broken down, that energy is transferred to this protein, which then causes this conformation change. That would be like your friend poking you in the side even harder, okay, with more energy. So when the protein is open to the inside of the cell, even though there's low concentration of calcium right here, calcium still can diffuse in, bind to the protein, and if ATP is available, changing this conformation, and then calcium is released to the outside of the cell, going from low concentration to high. So what kind of process is that? Is that passive? No, that's an active process. Going from low to high takes energy. What's the form of energy in this particular case? ATP, you see it in this nice circle right here. Okay. When a molecule can be transported using ATP from low concentration to high concentration, we typically call that a pump. Okay, just like taking water that's down in the earth, okay, for you to drink, what do you have to do? You got to pump it, you got to get it from low to high. It's going to require some pumping to do that. So here is a nice pump. Requires ATP. And in particular, the kind of active transport this is, since ATP is used, we call this primary active transport. We're going to see some other transport mechanisms that require energy but don't use ATP directly. That's a different kind of active transport. But if you see an ATP, it's going to be primary active transport. Here's a real important transporter in cells, all cells. Here's that nice phospholipid bilayer again. Here's a protein, and it's going to pump sodium from the inside of the cell to the outside, at the same time, it's going to pump potassium from the outside to the inside. Right? And inside the cell, there should be high concentration of potassium. Outside the cell, there should be high concentration of sodium. So let's just think of potassium right here. If potassium is going from low concentration to high, right, and it moves across the membrane, what kind of process is that, active or passive? It's active because it's going from low to high concentration. What about sodium going from low concentration to high? Is that active or passive? That's active transport as well. So both of these ions are being actively pumped, all right? And then I see the protein right here. It requires another molecule, namely ATP. And that's what we call, wasn't labeled on this slide right here, but I told you, what do we call it when ATP is being used? Primary active transport. So this right here, primary active transport, which actively transports potassium inside cells and sodium out all day long, right, that's primary active transport. So this is the sodium potassium ATP pump. And most of the energy that you eat every day just goes to driving all of these pumps in these cells. This is probably like the most important mechanism in your whole body. And you'll kind of appreciate that as we go through the class. Now here's something that's kind of interesting. Okay? The number of potassium that gets pumped inside the cell is only 2 for every 3 sodiums that get pumped out. All right, so 2 potassiums for every 3 sodiums. All right, and as we pump more positive ions out of the cell, what happens to the outside of the cell in terms of electrical charge compared to the number of that we put in? Then the outside of the cell becomes more positive, which is another way of saying that the inside of the cell becomes more negative as a result of that. So the sodium-potassium ATP pump is what we call electrogenic because it produces a voltage across the membrane, okay, because of these electrolytes that are not being pumped in equal directions. What do you call something that has a difference in voltage on 2 different places? Oh, I forgot. Ooh, but nobody called me. I'm glad. I forgot to turn off my cell phone. What do you have that has one of these things? Your cell phone has a battery. Any kind of device that separates electrical charges out, right, puts a negative charge on one side and a positive charge on the other side, that's a battery. Because what do these opposite charges like to do? They would like to recombine, right? And when they recombine, that can be used to do some kind of process for you. That can be used to do work. All right, so here is energy being expended to make a cell membrane act like a battery, and cells and life has figured out a way how to use that battery nature across the cell. All right, I want to talk about some other kinds of transport processes. All right, what else has a battery that you have? Doesn't have to be in your pocket. Battery in your car? Maybe you even drive home with your battery if it's an electric car, but maybe you have a gas engine and you just use the electric battery to get the gas motor started. You might have a calculator, maybe a flashlight with you. I don't know. Probably all kinds of devices. You have batteries. But it's a storage form of energy. Right? And energy can be stored across that cell membrane as an electrical voltage. All right, let's talk about secondary active transport. Okay, it requires ATP to first move sodium ions up its concentration gradient. Okay, and then secondary active transport, when sodium moves back down from high to low concentration, the movement of sodium can be coupled with the motion of a second molecule. Okay, and if it's active transport, that second molecule is going to do what? Go from high to low or low to high if it's active transport? Active transport is low to high. All right, so if we have a concentration gradient of something, that can be used to move another molecule from low concentration to high concentration. Right? And if it doesn't use ATP directly, we're going to call that secondary active transport. So let's look at this diagram right here. So here we have a wall with a ramp on it. And this is low concentration down here at the base of the ramp, and it signifies high concentration of a solute molecule when we get to the top of the ramp. And if we're going to move sodium up its concentration gradient like that, that's going to require energy because you're going from low concentration to high concentration. All right, and this big dark arrow right here, what kind of active transport is that? Is that primary or secondary, and how would you know? It's labeled primary because we see ATP. This kind of pump, right, requires ATP, just like on the previous slide. So sodium is moving up its concentration gradient because of ATP, and then we push it over to the edge, and after we push it over to the edge, what is sodium going to do? It's going to go back down its concentration gradient, but as it's moving, it's releasing energy, okay? And if it hits this teeter-totter mechanism, here we've loaded this teeter-totter with glucose, and if sodium falls onto this teeter-totter, what's going to happen to it? It's going to push glucose up its concentration gradient. All right, so it's going to throw glucose up in the air or up its concentration gradient. So glucose is now going from low to high concentration because sodium is going from high to low down its concentration gradient. There's enough energy in sodium going down its concentration gradient to move glucose up, but do you see any ATP in this mechanism right here? There's no ATP, so this is what we call secondary active transport. Right, whenever you have a gradient of something, that can be used as an energy source to drive some unfavorable reaction. Right, a concentration gradient is an energy source. Just like if you have a concentration gradient of electrical charge, that's an energy source. We just call that a battery. Okay, so here is a different kind of battery. Right, it's not based on electricity. It's just based on the concentration gradient of sodium. All right, so it requires energy in the form of a chemical gradient. That's what we call secondary active transport to move glucose across cells. Let's look at these examples right here. Okay, we see a cell membrane, extracellular fluid. Here's the intracellular fluid or cytoplasm. And where's sodium at a high concentration in a normal cell? Let's go back a couple slides. Sodium is high on the outside. Potassium is high on the inside. So you've got to remember that somehow. Right, that should just be like first nature in this class. Okay, I know I like to mention that in anatomy and other classes, but not every instructor does, but it's so important. So here you have sodium that's high outside the cell, and here you have glucose that's outside the cell. Okay, but now we have glucose. Okay, but remember, glucose cannot enter the cell right here because of this nonpolar region inside the membrane. All right, and let's just say that there's low concentration of glucose outside, but high inside. So if glucose was going to go from low to high, what kind of transport process would that be? Yeah, that would be an active transport process of some kind. All right, and what can be used? ATP could be used if it's primary active transport, but here's another way that it happens. All right, sodium is high on the outside, low on the inside, so sodium wants to go down its concentration gradient. There's energy in that gradient, so if both sodium and glucose bind to this protein, both sodium and glucose enter the cell, right? There's enough energy that the gradient of sodium can drag glucose along with it. So glucose can go from low concentration to high as long as sodium goes from high to low. All right, so in terms of glucose transport, right, that is active transport because it's going from low concentration to high. But what kind of active transport is that? Is that primary or secondary? Yeah, it's secondary because I don't see any ATP being used here whatsoever. So it's secondary active transport due to the concentration gradient of sodium. Okay, so when we talk about secondary active transport, there can be two kinds. There can be co-transport, actually I like to call it symport, and it's secondary active transport, and both solute molecules will move in the same direction. So we see sodium and glucose moving in the same direction, both from extracellular to intracellular. That's what we call a symporter. Right? But we can have an antiporter, or a counter-transport mechanism, in which case then glucose might go in one direction from outside to inside, while sodium or some other solute is going from inside to outside. That's an antiport mechanism. So sometimes they go in the same direction, sometimes they go in opposite directions, but since ATP is not being used, what kind of transport is it? Secondary active transport. It's still just utilizing a concentration gradient. Now why is this really important? Okay. Let's take a look at this slide right here. I see an epithelium. What kind of epithelium is this? Well, these cells kind of look cuboidal to me here. Okay, but what else? How many layers do you see? Yeah, it's simple. It's just a nice simple cuboidal epithelium right here that's making a lining of this tube. Here's the lumen of a tube. This could be the lumen of a kidney tubule or maybe small intestine. And then here is the blood or extracellular space inside your body. So this is outside your body. This is inside your body. And let's just consider the kidney. The kidneys filter a lot of glucose, like just by filtration. And glucose is an important energy molecule, and glucose should not end up in urine, right? And it should be resorbed and put back into your body so that ATP can be made utilizing glucose. Okay, but if you do have glucose ending up in the urine, what do we call that condition? Glucose urea, that's produced by diabetes when your blood glucose is so high that this mechanism gets overwhelmed and then glucose ends up in the urine, right, and you lose it from your body. That's a kind of a terrible circumstance because you're losing that energy. All right, so here is a kidney tubule, or for instance, if there's glucose in your small intestine after you've had a meal, then that glucose should be absorbed and put in your body. It shouldn't be lost. All right, so this is a good way to get glucose from a place where you're going to lose it to being put back inside your body right here. So how does it work? In the fluid of a kidney tubule, there's going to be a high concentration of sodium, okay, and a low concentration of glucose. But here is this symporter, right, the co-transport protein right here that can use the gradient of sodium because it's high on the outside of the cell, and sodium is typically low inside the cell, so sodium wants to rush in. There's enough energy in this gradient to move glucose from a low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. What kind of transport is this? It's co-transport, but what kind of transport is co-transport? Do you see ATP being used right here? No. So it's not primary. It's secondary active transport. So glucose enters the cell, right, and becomes a high concentration inside the cell, and now glucose is low outside in the blood. Does glucose want to go from inside the cell to outside the cell? Yeah, it wants to go down its concentration gradient. It wants to go from high to low, all right? But remember, glucose is a polar compound, likes to dissolve in water, but not the cell membrane. So it needs a carrier protein right here for facilitated diffusion. Diffusion is what? From high to low. Okay, so here is diffusion, high to low. Now, this system only works if we keep sodium at a low concentration inside the cell. If a lot of sodium enters from the lumen of this kidney tubule or small intestine, then the sodium increases inside the cell, and this secondary active transporter stops working. But what maintains sodium at a low concentration inside the cell? The sodium-potassium ATP pump right here is always pumping sodium out, so sodium goes across the epithelium into the blood. So both sodium and glucose are being absorbed, all right, and that's run by the sodium-potassium ATP pump. The other two things that you should notice from this slide is, what about potassium? Is it being moved? Yes, and in what direction compared to sodium? The opposite direction, all right? That's going to be really important in the last week of this class. Okay, you see that sodium moves in one direction while potassium goes in the other. Now, what kind of transport is this right here? Sodium is going from low to high, so that's got to be active transport. Potassium is going from low to high, that's got to be active transport. Now, specifically, what kind of active transport? Because you know two. Here's ATP, that's primary active transport. So this secondary active transport here is being driven by this primary active transport here that requires ATP to do that. When you run out of ATP, then this co-transport mechanism here, the secondary active transport can't work either, right? And you can't then move glucose from low to high concentration. And this works so efficiently in the normal person that by the time this filtrate leaves your body, there's zero concentration of glucose in urine, okay, if somebody's healthy, by this mechanism. All right, so you can see that this pump is really important for just moving molecules across membranes. Bulk transport. Sometimes molecules are too big to even bind to a protein. The particles are too big, so in that particular case, the cell membrane is going to form this little pucker or pouch in it because there are microtubules and microfilaments that attach to membrane proteins, and microtubules can push and pull on organelles or even the cell membrane. It can give the cell its shape and can move organelles around inside the cell. So it forms this little dimple in the cell membrane, and then it folds back on itself. So whatever was, it forms that invagination. So whatever particles are in solution on the outside of the cell are trapped inside this vesicle, and this pouch breaks away from the cell membrane. Now those particles are inside the cell, inside this vesicle. And then it can fuse with other kind of vesicles like a lysosome, where these particles are then digested, broken down into building blocks. Like if these are big polysaccharides, right, if they're being digested down into smaller particles, what would these big particles then yield for us? If this is a polysaccharide right here, after it's broken down, you would have monosaccharides. You'd have nice simple sugars that the cell could use for its own purposes, like glucose, for instance. So when something moves from outside to inside by this process, we call that endocytosis. But the reverse process can happen. You can have maybe a protein or a modified protein inside the cell, and then this vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, hopping a ride on a microtubule system, fusing with the cell membrane. Then these particles are secreted outside the cell, maybe like mucus in a goblet cell, for instance. All right, that process where something leaves the cell is called exocytosis, and this requires energy to do. So it's an active transport mechanism because it takes energy for those microtubules to move. So, oh, I told you already. Is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport? It's active transport. Requires ATP. Okay, we're going to start talking about membrane potential. And so you sort of know what a membrane is, right? A membrane is this phospholipid bilayer right here. But potential, I'm not sure anybody knows what potential is. Okay, there's something called potential energy and kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is when some mass is in motion. If you get hit by that mass, you feel that energy. Okay, but there's also potential energy, right? I can have this Pepsi bottle on the floor. It has low potential energy. It's not moving, but I can lift it up to the tabletop, and now it has potential energy because if I hit it, what is it going to do? Will it just hover right there? No, it's going to drop to the floor, right? It's going to go in motion because it has potential energy when it's above the floor. So membrane potential means that there is some energy stored across the membrane. There's some potential energy. And typically when we say potential, we mean a voltage. Right? So there's some electrical energy across the membrane. And how would we store energy in form of electricity across the membrane? We would separate charges out. We would put negative charges on one side, positive charges on the other. Because what do those charges want to do? They attract each other. They want to neutralize each other. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage? All the batteries you have. Probably have a couple batteries in your pocket. All right, and how many terminals does a battery have? It's got two, right? And one is going to be positive with respect to the other one, which is going to be negative. And you could measure that voltage with an instrument called a voltmeter. And some of you might have a voltmeter at home if you work on your cars or whatever. Okay? Car I had in college, I probably needed lots of voltmeters to figure out what was going on with it. Okay, so here we have a cell, and inside the cell, there are a bunch of anions that are trapped. They can't get out. What is an anion again? It's a negatively charged particle, right? And these are big proteins that can't leave the cell membrane, and they all have a nice negative charge on them. So if we forget all these other particles and just think of these proteins that are inside the cell, what charge is inside the cell compared to the outside? It's going to be negative compared to the outside. Right? All right. But there's something that can actually move across the cell membrane. Okay? And let's talk about potassium. What kind of charge does potassium have? It's a positive. Right? And potassium can move. It can move by diffusion across the cell membrane. Right, so if we have a lot of potassium on the outside of the cell and these big anions inside the cell, guess what potassium wants to do? It wants to enter the cell to neutralize this charge just by the electrical attraction. Okay, there could be another attraction of why potassium wants to enter the cell. Could somebody think of another reason why potassium might want to enter the cell? Okay, it could be by concentration gradient. If there's low concentration of potassium inside the cell, high on the outside, then potassium wants to enter the cell just to go down its concentration gradient. So two reasons potassium might want to enter the cell. One is due to electrical attraction, and the other is due to concentration gradient, if it's high on the outside and low on the inside. Okay, sodium, let's not even consider sodium. It's not permeable, and also sodium is kicked out of the cell by that pump. All right, so potassium is entering the cell, going down its concentration gradient, and also due to this electrical charge right here. All right, and then as potassium enters the cell and neutralizes this negative charge, then the inside of the cell becomes less negative. All right, but also potassium then starts to accumulate inside the cell. So what happens to diffusion by concentration gradient? As more potassium enters the cell, what happens to diffusion by concentration gradient? If the concentration gradient disappears completely, what happens to diffusion? Completely stops. Okay? All right, so if the concentration of potassium is exactly the same, then the force for diffusion disappears completely because the concentration gradient is the same. But what happens if you still have a little bit more of electrical charge? That's still going to draw some potassium inside the cell to neutralize that electrical charge. So these negative charges that are fixed inside the cell can cause an uneven concentration of potassium across the cell membrane, even though it can move back and forth, because the electrical attraction is pulling it in, but the chemical concentration is forcing it out, and there will eventually be an equilibrium established where the electric force balances out the diffusion force due to concentration gradient. That will form an equilibrium. And we call that the equilibrium potential. All right, so under that circumstance, if we put a voltmeter across the cell membrane, we're going to see that the inside of the cell is a little bit negative compared to the outside. The outside is going to be a little bit positive. And that voltage we measure as minus 90 millivolts. And what do you call something that has this voltage across two parts of it? A battery. So every cell in your body is acting like a battery. Let me go over that one more time. So we're thinking about potassium, okay? And if there are no fixed anions right here, let's get rid of these fixed anions, and potassium can move across the cell membrane, right? And we put a high concentration here and low concentration right here, what's going to happen? Potassium is going to enter until the concentration is the same, all right? And then there's going to be no net diffusion, right? Okay? All right, but now let's put these negative charges on the inside. It was equal concentration at one time. Now let's put these anions back in there. What are these anions going to do? They're going to draw a few more potassiums inside the cell to neutralize that electrical charge. So now you have a higher concentration inside the cell compared to outside. And it doesn't completely neutralize, right, this negative charge inside the cell, because as the concentration of potassium gets higher inside the cell, guess what likes to happen? Then it's going to like to diffuse out, go down its concentration gradient. But there will be a point in time when the concentration stops, or the movement of potassium stops, right? And there will be a voltage across the membrane, which is going to be 90 millivolts, that actually balances out exactly the force for diffusion for that potassium trying to leave the cell. We call that the equilibrium potential. And we can calculate that what it is. The equilibrium potential is when the electrical force and diffusion forces are exactly equal and opposite, and then there's going to be no net movement of potassium across the cell membrane. But it's going to be higher inside the cell than outside. If these anions weren't there, the concentration would be exactly the same across the membrane. All right, so what does every cell in your body act like? It acts like a battery for this basic reason right here. All right, we can calculate what that equilibrium potential is for one ion at a time, and we're going to use the Nernst equation to do that. All right, we have a number of ions that we're going to calculate. One is potassium, one is chloride. Guess what another one is? Sodium. All right, so we're going to look at that next time. So we're going to start right here with the Nernst equation. This is what you need your scientific calculator for on a test. So you might want to bring that to class next time with you, so we can calculate the equilibrium potential using the Nernst equation next time.